Welcome to NACE Clinical Highlights. I'm Dr. Greg Sherman, Chief Medical Officer for NACE. Joining me today is Dr. Eldrin Lewis. Dr. Lewis is an Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a cardiovascular and heart transplant specialist. He also serves as Director of the Cardiovascular Clerkship Program at Brigham and Women's Hospital and is a national thought leader in cardiovascular disease and particularly heart failure. I'm really excited to spend a few minutes with him to hear his insights on heart failure, particularly with preserved ejection fraction. Thanks for joining me, Eldrin.
Oh, thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate it.
I'm happy to have you for a few minutes today. So heart failure is a challenging issue for all of us in practice, but more recently we're hearing more data about HFpEF, and I realize that that's a really challenging condition, not only to diagnose maybe, but also to treat. So I thought maybe we'd spend a couple of minutes talking to our colleagues about HFpEF. So when a patient presents with dyspnea on exertion, if we do an echocardiogram, if we're thinking heart failure and the echo is low, well, that's pretty easy. We know that's HFrEF, heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. There's this protocol we might have in our mind. But if the echo comes back as normal, that creates a little bit of a challenge. So I thought maybe you could sort of walk through what we do with those patients, how to really get to the right diagnosis of HFpEF in those patients that are presenting with some shortness of breath.
Absolutely. You know, I think the real challenge when the echocardiogram is normal, the ejection fraction is 50% or higher, is the shortness of breath, fatigue, or the constellation of symptoms actually related to the ejection fraction? As you mentioned before, if you do an echocardiogram and the ejection fraction is low, the pretest probability of heart failure goes way up. You know, you say this is the shortness of breath is probably because of that. The problem with the preserved ejection fraction is there's no kind of classic pathophysiologic finding on echo that says, aha, this normal ejection fraction is in fact because of heart failure and that one is not. We try to look at parameters of diastolic dysfunction, and I wouldn't go through all of those details, but the one thing that I would emphasize is diastolic dysfunction is nonspecific. And what I mean by that is if we were to look at 1,000 patients in the community who are over the age of 70, a large percentage of them will actually have diastolic dysfunction, completely normal asymptomatic patients mm-hmm. who don't have the syndrome of heart failure. So we can't look at diastolic dysfunction and say that means this is because of heart failure. Conversely, we have patients who clearly have heart failure. They have volume overload. They have signs of heart failure, S3 gallops, peripheral edema, shortness of breath, and they're very symptomatic. And their echocardiogram has no diastolic dysfunction at all. So what does that mean? Does it mean that they don't have heart failure? Or does it mean that our current tools are not that good? So what I do is to try to put a puzzle together. So that puzzle includes, or the pieces of the puzzle includes biomarkers. So if you have an elevated N-terminal pro-BNP or BNP, and you have a normal ejection fraction with shortness of breath, it's probably heart failure. The second thing I would do is look at risk factors. So if they have a large number of risk factors related to heart failure, such as hypertension, diabetes, and others, then I would be more concerned about heart failure. I do look at the echo, you know, and so if there are structural abnormalities, such as left ventricular hypertrophy, diastolic dysfunction, strain, you know, using longitudinal circumferential strain and strain rate, if you have strain abnormalities, or if you have valvular abnormalities such as aortic stenosis, mitral regurgitation, tricuspid regurgitation, or anything that would consider that would contribute. And then finally, kind of looking at evidence of pulmonary hypertension through tricuspid regurgitant velocity. So if you have an elevated TRV, then I would be concerned as well. So that's the third piece of the puzzle in trying to understand it. The fourth piece is an exclusion piece, and that is look for other reasons they're short of breath. You know, and so do they have uncontrolled hypertension? Do they have significant pulmonary hypertension in the absence of other manifestations of heart failure? Do they have lung disease? You know, and so getting a pulmonary function test or getting hypoxia. And then one thing that a lot of people don't evaluate but is particularly important in the elderly, and that is chronotropic incompetence. You know, so a poor heart rate response. So a lot of times I'll put them on the treadmill to look for their heart rate response to exercise. And you'll be surprised at how many people basically don't increase their heart rate with exercise. So that chronotropic incompetence can be an early manifestation of sinus node disease. Mm-hmm. And then the one thing that I would absolutely exclude, you know, is coronary artery disease. You know, so if someone has occult coronary artery disease, especially when they're older women and people with diabetes, they may not have classic chest pain, but in fact, shortness of breath. So you do the echo, you see that they're preserved, their EF is preserved, but in fact, you could be sitting on significant coronary disease that, if treated, can not only prevent a heart attack, but also may be able to improve their symptoms.
Right. So there's so many different avenues that you really need to pursue to really arrive at that HFpEF diagnosis and make sure you haven't missed these other things.
That's right.
One of the things that has been asked about a lot in many of the conferences we're doing is the role of BNP in this and how you interpret that. That's one of the things that you mentioned, and I know a lot of people are curious because that's easier to do in a, certainly in a primary care office, to order as a test, but it becomes a little confusing if a patient has other concomitant disease or chronic kidney disease and how to interpret that. Any thoughts on where we should go with that particular biomarker?
Yes, I think that's very important because it is easy to do for a clinician, whether you're a physician, nurse practitioner, PA, or any physician extender. If I were to look at BNP, in general, if the BNP is greater than 100, that's considered abnormal. But I would say if it's between 100 and 500, I call that kind of that intermediate zone. And that's where the specificity for heart failure is not as good. So in patients who have a BNP between 100 and 500 certainly can have that because of their age, older age, the fact that they're women, the fact that they have chronic kidney disease, coronary disease, prior pulmonary embolism, pneumonias, infections, lung disease, et cetera. And so you would want to try to exclude those situations. But if it's greater than 500, the specificity for heart failure increases dramatically. So I would start with that, you know, and if their BNP is greater than 500, then I would start thinking about heart failure. There is one caveat, because we talk about things that will increase the BNP. But we also know that there's one key factor which happens to be very prevalent in the United States, and that's obesity. So patients with obesity, even with confirmed heart failure and confirmed elevated filling pressures, will have lower BNP. And we don't fully understand the mechanism. We think it's because of the adiposity, and they have a more effective way of breaking down BNP endogenously. But nevertheless, you'll have patients who can have normal BNPs despite having heart failure because of the obesity.
That's really fascinating. I haven't heard that before, and it just makes me think about how much more challenging that obese patient is in the hospital if we're trying to assess either their BNP on the way in or their BNP on the way out. It may not be as reliable a marker as for thinner patients.
That's exactly right. And the frustrating part, of course, is the fact that our physical exam skills may be muted a little bit in the obese patient. If we're trying to assess jugular venous pressure, it may be harder to evaluate their jugular vein, you know, if they're obese.
Sure. Let's switch gears a little bit because there's so much information coming out. Let's say we've made the diagnosis. We feel pretty confident. We've ruled out everything else. We have a patient with HFpEF. Where's the data set right now with optimal treatment? It's a little bit harder than with HFrEF. So where are we at with the studies that have come out?
Yes, and unfortunately, I can count on my hands the number of large clinical trials in HFpEF. And this is because of that heterogeneous population. That being said, we have a few near misses. So for CHARM Preserve, they looked at angiotensin receptor blocker. It was also an eye preserve as well. So that was candesartan and irbesartan respectively. And both of those didn't show a benefit in terms of outcomes. There have been small studies looking at digoxin, but we didn't have a definitive large enough population in order to answer the question. And also perindopril or ACE inhibitors and beta blockers, nabivolol. So all of these studies have been negative. They haven't shown a benefit. There are two studies that I would highlight. The first one is TOPCAT, and in full disclosure, this is a study that we ran, NIH-sponsored, and it looked at spironolactone versus placebo. In the entire population, we randomized patients in North America and South America, but also in Russia and the Republic of Georgia. It turns out retrospectively, which is quite frustrating, that we feel that the patients who were enrolled in Russia and Georgia, which represented about 45% of the total population, these patients actually probably didn't have heart failure. The reason I say that is because they actually truly had a one-year mortality rate that was similar to those who had hypertension and maybe some early diabetes and coronary artery disease, but certainly not in the what you would expect to see in heart failure. So they had an annualized mortality rate in the placebo arm of only about 2%. And we know that heart failure, unfortunately, is a lethal disease. So the fact that it's only 2% mortality risk and 1% heart failure hospitalization risk concerns us about whether or not they actually had heart failure. So in the overall population for TopCat, the primary outcome, which was death, you know, cardiovascular death, heart failure hospitalization, or aborted cardiac arrest, we just missed statistical significance. But if we looked at the entire population and looked at heart failure hospitalization, there was actually a significant risk reduction in heart failure hospitalization in patients randomized to spironolactone. And then if we only looked at the Americas, where patients had disease similar to what we're expecting to see with heart failure, even for the primary outcome, for cardiovascular death by itself, as well as heart failure hospitalization, all three were statistically significant with spironolactone. So certainly, you know, anytime you look at something post hoc, you have to look at it with a bit of skepticism. But I think given the fact that there is no therapy that we can use pharmacologically for treating these patients, I think it's reasonable. So based upon this, the AHA-ACC guidelines actually changed the guidelines and said for HFpEF patients with ejection fractions of higher than 45% with symptomatic heart failure, and if they have reasonable renal dysfunction, you know, so their GFR is greater than 30 or their serum creatinine is less than 2.5, mm-hmm. you can use spironolactone for treating these patients.
What about eplerenone? Is that an equal choice?
It is. And so the benefit, even though we didn't use eplerenone, we used spironolactone in the study. There's no biological reason that eplerenone would be any different. The key benefit of using eplerenone is that you don't have to deal with the off-target side effects. So about 11% of men will develop gynecomastia, and about 10% of men will develop erectile dysfunction with spironolactone. And that risk is less than 1% for both of those side effects.
But I imagine it's probably reasonable to start with spironolactone. It's probably going to be a less expensive option than the switch, or do you immediately go for eplerenone to avoid side effects from the get-go?
Yeah, historically, I've gone with spironolactone first because it is so cheap. You know, on average, it's like 13 cents a day, so it's hard to get cheaper than that.
Right.
But now eplerenone is generic, so a lot of times I'll have discussions with my patients about it. The copay sometimes can be a little higher with the eplerenone.
Okay, what about Paragon? That's the other new trial that's come out. What does that tell us?
Exactly. So Paragon HF was the largest study to date, you know, that looked at patients with HFpEF. And it randomized patients with heart failure to a combination to either sacubitril valsartan, which is basically an ARB with a neprilysin inhibitor, versus valsartan alone. So in essence, we're basically saying, what is the additive benefit of neprilysin inhibition? And the reason this is important is twofold. The first is because we know from the reduced EF patients that sacubitril valsartan was actually superior to ACE inhibitors, enalapril, which had previously been undefeated in any clinical trial, you know, in heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. And the second reason is the biology. We know that BNP is biologically active and it causes vasodilatation. It helps diuresis, and it actually improves outcomes. So in the Paradigm HF, there was a significant risk reduction in cardiovascular death, mortality, all-cause death, as well as heart failure hospitalization in the combination. So in Paragon HF, we looked at HFpEF, and there just missed statistical significance. This was just presented in Paris at the European Society of Cardiology and was published in the New England Journal. And what this has demonstrated is that there was a near miss for the combined primary endpoint of cardiovascular death and heart failure hospitalizations. If you look at total hospitalizations, there was also a near miss with 18% risk reduction, but the confidence interval was right at 1.0. So it was as close as you can get to a positive study. But ultimately, I would put Paragon HF into the same category as I would put TopCat, that basically likely it's a near miss. The difference is we've had a chance to really look at TopCat, and we know that there are some patients that contributed to missing the primary endpoint. For Paragon HF, it's a fresh study, and there are many, many sub-studies that will be coming out. So I would say stay tuned, because I know that at the American Heart Association, we'll be talking about some of the other potential impacts of sacubitril valsartan in HFpEF. Mm-hmm. And I think over the course of the next 6 months, we'll have a better idea as to whether or not we should consider using sacubitril valsartan for the treatment of HFpEF.
Do you think that there might be study redesigned to improve upon the ability to select those patients really that might be the most appropriate to benefit to fine-tune that therapy?
I think so. And the reason is because, as we alluded to before, HFpEF is a very heterogeneous population. So if we were to look at the clinical characteristics, there are many phenotypes. And in fact, this has been published by Dr. Sanjeev Shah, who's one of my colleagues who works at Northwestern. And you can actually identify clear phenotypes. And if we can identify the right phenotype and then treat, that can be beneficial. The other reason it's a problem is because there are a lot of other factors, including inflammation, hypertension, uncontrolled vasculature, kind of ventricular vascular coupling, chronic kidney disease, all of which, and then obesity, all of which can contribute to symptom burden, and the treatment to try to improve outcomes may be, in fact, different.
Great. Do you have any insight on what's next on the horizon? Any tidbits for our learners of what might be coming in this area?
I think one of the most exciting areas is actually the SGLT2 inhibitors. And the reason I say that, this is a drug that was developed for the treatment of diabetes. And we don't quite understand the mechanism as to why it works. But we know that it works by dumping glucose into the bladder, and then you kind of have a diuresis effect. The interesting thing is the focus was really to see if there's a benefit on macrovascular endpoints. And in fact, in the EMPA-REG study, it was the first study ever, to my knowledge, where you had a randomized trial to drug versus placebo, where you actually showed a reduction, clear reduction in major adverse cardiovascular events. So in patients with high-risk diabetes, you actually saw a risk reduction in cardiovascular death, all-cause death, the combination, as well as heart failure hospitalizations. And in fact, the reason I'm excited about this is because there have been several other studies now, including real-world examples with real CVD, consistently showing a reduction in heart failure hospitalizations. And if you look at the subset of patients who didn't have heart failure in the beginning, you actually saw a significant, almost a little over a 40% risk reduction in the development of heart failure. Given how lethal heart failure is, that's an important target. Finally, there was a busy conference over in Paris, so I guess people were focused on the science and not the benefit of being in Paris, because the DAPA-HF study came out as well. You know, and this was a study that looked at heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, and the interesting thing is it was with and without diabetes. So now they're kind of saying, forget about diabetes. And they show, once again, a risk reduction in cardiovascular mortality, heart failure hospitalizations, and the combination. So I would say, as we move forward with HFpEF, there are several studies looking at heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, looking at SGLT2 inhibitors, and that's with and without diabetes.
Right, and I think the FDA is moving for an urgent review for, I think, an independent label for treatment of heart failure with dapagliflozin.
That's exactly right, yes.
Right. Let me finish up with one last point, because there's a lot of noise about amyloidosis, and that really is another contributing factor to HFpEF, which is really what we're focusing on there. Without a full discussion about amyloidosis, can you give us some of the highlights of where we're at with it and how to do a better job of recognizing it?
Absolutely. So, you know, when I was a trainee about 25 years ago, I hate to say that, amyloid was a death sentence. And it still is. But, you know, the teaching when I was in medical school was the onset of amyloid, you have a median survival of 6 months. What we're realizing is we just diagnosed them way too late. Mm-hmm. Now, and we had limited therapies. So basically they said, just prepare to die and let's focus on goals of care. Now we know that there's AL amyloid, which is what we know a lot about, this kind of light chain disease. But you also have this TTR amyloid, so both wild type and as well as familial. And this is a transthyretin mutation that increases protein deposits. The problem with it is that it causes thickening of the left ventricle, diastolic dysfunction, and ultimately a lot of arrhythmias, including atrial and ventricular arrhythmias, sudden death, as well as, unfortunately, progressive heart failure and death. So we now know that if we can identify these patients earlier, we can be very aggressive. For certain types of TTR or transthyretin mutation amyloid, there are therapies that are available. You know, the one that has been FDA approved is tafamidis, based upon a trial that was completed last year showing remarkably a survival benefit with tafamidis. And so as a consequence, we really need to identify these patients, especially because if you look at the subgroups, it appears that the patients who have class 1 and class 2 functional class, so less symptomatic disease, actually do the best. So they do better than the patients who have more advanced diseases. So I would say that if you see a patient who has LVH on echocardiogram that's out of proportion to the severity of their hypertension or the duration of their hypertension, if you have patients with an echo that looks classic for amyloid, and that would be a thick ventricle with thickened valves, typically all four valves, a thickened right ventricle as well. And if you couple that with patients who actually have carpal tunnel syndrome, or they've had carpal tunnel release surgery, all of these are signs that they may have amyloidosis. And the nice thing about it is if you look for it, there are actually easy ways to make the diagnosis. You don't have to go straight to endomyocardial biopsy, which many of our clinicians may not have access to. Mm-hmm. So you can actually do a pyrophosphate scan, a cardiac MRI, and there are algorithms that we can follow. But the key thing is that you have to recognize it. So once again, I would say if you have a wall thickness, that's great. And you don't have another explanation for it, especially in young people. If you have low voltage in the setting of thick ventricle on echo, if you have regurgitant lesions throughout all four of your valves with thickened valves, and if you have RVH on the echo as well, couple that with carpal tunnel and hypotension, you know, then I would be concerned about amyloid.
Well, Eldrin, you are preaching to the choir, and I think our primary care colleagues out there are really good at being detectives and figuring out, but taking a step back and thinking about the big picture. And I encourage them always when I'm talking or sharing with colleagues that if your specialist is not thinking about it, it's okay for you to think about it. You know, we know the patients really well and can put together these disparate symptoms that may not make sense together. But the more I think we educate them, we can bring that to the table. So I think that's great information.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sherman. Appreciate it.
So, Eldrin, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I think this has been super informative. I think you've done a great job helping our colleagues to take better care of the patients. So once again, thanks for being with me.
Thank you very much, Greg.
If you're more interested in learning about cardiovascular disease and heart failure, go to the website at naceonline.com and register for one of our many enduring activities that we've developed. Please like us on Facebook at NACME to be part of our online social media community and get access to other content and programs that we share. I want to thank you, our audience, for joining us for this show. I hope you've learned something new and look forward to having you back at our next podcast. Thank you very much. Let me redo that.
Yeah, that's fine. Just go ahead.
I want to thank you, our audience, for joining us for this show. Hope you've learned something new you didn't know before. We look forward to bringing you more content and more interviews with our faculty. Thanks so much.